That or the library. I owe you an overdue map, which I admit, which I was looking for, and I, for some reason, did not have in my notes, so I ended up skipping it, but found it. So I will share this with you today. This is just sort of old material, but I figured better late than never. This is a really interesting map because it's the map of Shevet Dan's original Nachla when they were assigned the west near the area of the coast of and Yafo. And we went through the Psukim in Yehoshua, which we went through the Psukim in Yehoshua, which defined all of the various cities to which Dan was assigned. What we didn't have at the time was the map. So if you take a look at this map, you'll see the easiest way to zero in on where we are is Yafo on the left northwest corner, which is essentially Tel Aviv today. Yafo, Bnei Brak, the Yarkon River, etc. And if you look at dead center of the map, you'll see Shalavim, which is the area of Latrun today. So the cities assigned to Shevet Dan, the names of the cities we saw, Ayalon, Eshta'ol and Tzorah, we saw a great deal in the story of Shimshon, and we have it here as well. You get a sense of where they are. They're sort of almost due south of Shalavim in the valley, but not quite on the coast. Beit Shemesh or Ir Shemesh is there as well. So you sort of Ashdod in the southwest. So you sort of get a sense of the geography of what was originally Shevet Dan before they moved north. All right.
There's an Ashdod and an Ashdod Yam.
Yeah, there's a number of different places mentioned in Tanakh. Today there are different cities. But Ashdod today is essentially where Ashdod was in the time of Tanakh. So is Yafo and Bnei Brak, or Beit Shemesh near Tel Shemesh. They are cities around. All right. Everybody get a copy of this map? Okay, we are in the middle of a discussion with regards to this enigmatic phrase by Mi Mehem Ein Melech B'Yisrael. We started last week with a conversation about the second half of the phrase, namely Ish Hayashar Be'Nav Yaseh, the notion of doing what is each man what is right in their own eyes, which we understood or interpreted not just as a kind of reflection on anarchy, haphazard, no governance, no government, no king, no shofet, no leadership. We saw it much more in a very specific context, namely, anybody remember?
Decentralizing sacrifice.
Right, the decentralization of a place of the Mikdash, the notion that appears in Sefer Dvarim, Perek Yud-Bet, of the role of a single central location defined in the Torah as Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place which God will choose. And the two phrases that stand out in contrast, therefore, is the phrase that the Torah uses to describe the Mikdash, which is the Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, the place that God will choose to place his Shekhinah there, in contrast to the decentralization or the haphazard way in which the idolatry of the nations in Canaan operate, which is Ish Kol Yashar Ben Av Yaseh, every man doing what is right in their own eyes. And in a spiritual context, in a context of avoda, of korbanot. It's not just a general statement, it's specific to the world of, to the context of, the role of the Mikdash. On the one hand, you have Makom Hashem Yivchar Hashem, place that God will choose, and on the other hand, you have the notion of each person doing what they would want in their own eyes, meaning bringing sacrifices wherever they want, whenever they want, in any mountain, in any hill, in a kind of decentralized context. And the message that the Torah wants to convey is that part of monotheism, part of the notion of the message of the Torah of Hashem Echad is that just as we have one God, we have one place in which we serve God. There isn't this notion of Mikdash everywhere and anywhere. It's one location, one place that God will choose. So it's the contrast between God's choice of location, Makom Yivchar Hashem, one Mikdash, one city. And there's an association there, a very powerful and very important association between the idea of one God, one temple, one Mikdash, and one city in which that Mikdash takes place. Hence the mitzvot of the Torah of Aliyah L'Rego. What's the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Rego? They have to come to that place. And it's referred to as Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, at the place that God will choose. It's not just, it's not only God's place, but it's God's choice, in contrast to man's choice. Makom Ishi Yashar Beinav. Yes. It's one city, one place, one Mikdash, one God, one service, one set of laws. Everything is singular. Because that's what the Torah's message was, in contrast to the world in which, the pagan world in which they were entering. And in that context, we suggested that the story of Pesach Micha fits into this phrase, in those days, we had returned to this kind of mentality of not just anarchy, but specific to the contrast to the Mishkan, or specific to the contrast of Pesach Micha. What was Pesach Micha? A person took an idol, made himself a little temple, made himself an altar, appointed himself a kohen, built himself a clothing of the kahuna, built himself a trafim or a choshen mishpat. It was exact replica of what we would normally associate with the Mishkan, or the components of a Mishkan, and set it up in Har Ephraim. And we'll talk about the significance of the location in a moment. And then Shevet Dan comes to, they liked it so much, they took it and they moved it up to the Golan Heights together with the rest of Shevet Dan. It's the whole story is about the contrast between the Ishi Yashar Beinav Yaseh, this kind of decentralized anarchy of spiritual anarchy, where everybody's building their own temples and their own rituals, in relation to the Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem, and the specific location that the Torah set out for what would eventually become the location of the Mishkan, Shiloh, and ultimately the Mikdash in Yerushalayim. So far, that's been our point of that's where we reached, I think, at the end of last week's shiur, correct?
Okay. Last week, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, you brought up the idea that the seriousness of having trafim or anything like that was so anathema that you can't even, like, have a museum with them. So I was curious because, like, if you go opposite the Israel Museum, you have a historical museum, and they have these little trufim, and they say, this is what Rachel hid, you know, and they're little tiny metal things, and I didn't know I couldn't go in there.
Well, I didn't say you couldn't go in there. I just said that it's a violation of what the Torah had demanded of us in the land of Canaan when we entered into the land of Israel. It doesn't mean you can't go in there. It just means that, I mean, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to remove. There is a mitzvah in the Torah to remove all idolatry from the land and not to allow any idolatry to remain. Is that a mitzvah that we are empowered and able to fulfill today to its maximum? I suspect not. I think if you think about broader contexts of that mitzvah, I think you'd find that there are other areas and other dimensions of that mitzvah which we are unable to fulfill today. There are many mitzvot in the Torah that we are unable to fulfill today in today's context in Israel.
No, I was just curious about that.
But conceptually, yeah.
And would that include, like, the Bamot? Like, HUC has a Bama from one of those southern towns. So you actually could see what a Bama looks like?
Again, theoretically, the answer would be yes. There are many mitzvot in the Torah.
I mean, there's all sorts of ways to say.
Yeah, museums are a modern phenomenon. Some of them, conceptually, the Torah believe in museums. Probably not, but that's not the issue. There are so many mitzvot related to the land of Israel that we can't fulfill today because of the context in which we live. There's a mitzvah to build a mikdash. Do we build a mikdash?
Okay,
so you want to list a litany of mitzvot that we don't fulfill today because the circumstances are such that we don't fulfill. Right? That's one of a whole host of hundreds of them.
I'm just saying that I never heard that before, so to me it's very interesting that, you know, I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah, but that is correct. Torah wanted us. All right. Which brought us to the second half of this discussion, which I promised you, Bezrat Hashem, we would focus on today, which is the irony of an entire story devoted to this notion of, here the Torah says, mandates us to create a place of Makom HaShivchar Hashem, that God will choose. And here we have an entire story related to the notion of idolatry spreading Ish Yeshev Ben Av Yaaseh as the exact opposite of Makom HaShivchar Hashem. Right, this idea of man's choice versus God's choice, Avodah Zarah versus Avodat Hashem, in the context of Pesach Micha. And yet, we are in a time frame in which the Mishkan and Shiloh is operating. Mishkan and Shiloh is mentioned at the end of the entire story. How did we reach this point where we've re-entered this time frame of Ish Yeshev Ben Av Yaaseh when the Mishkan, which is the Makom HaShivchar Hashem, right? The Mishkan is that place that God will choose. The Mishkan is sitting there, and Pesach Micha is operating. How did this irony come about? So that's the part of the story that I wanted to address, and so sort of our postscript or our last piece on Pesach Micha, Bezrat Hashem. When we finish this unit, then our next stop is the story of Pelegish Begimah. Let's go back to the text for a moment. I pointed this out a few times when we read the story, but I just want to draw our attention to this again. Perek Yud Zayin. Perek Yud Zayin. If you go back to the part, leaving the introduction for a moment, starting with verse 7, Pasuk Zayin, Vayhi Na'ar, Mibet Lechem Yudah, Mimishpachat Yudah, Vulevi, Vugasham, we talked about this Levi. Pasuk Chet, Vayelech Ha'ish Mehair Bet Lechem Yehudah, Lagur Ba'ashe Yimtza. This Levi leaves the area of Bet Lechem Yehudah, begins a journey to travel somewhere, wherever he may find himself. Vayavo Har Ephraim, and he reaches Har Ephraim. Ad Beit Micha la'asot darko, and he finds himself in the house of Micha on his journey. Take a look in chapter 18, pasuk bet. Vayishlechu b'nei Dan m'mishpachtam, and b'nei Dan send their mission of 5 spies out from Shevet Dan in the south to go find themselves land in the north. Vayishlechu b'nei Dan m'mishpachtam chamisha anashim mikzotam anashim b'nei chayel mitzora'u u'me'eshta'ol. 5 people got sent out from the area of Etzora'u Neshto'ol, which I showed you on the map is due south of Shalavim. L'ragel et ha'aretz u'lechokra, to spy out the land, to investigate it. And they said to them, chiku et ha'aretz, based on what we said about Shevet Dan, do they know which direction they're going? These five emissaries of Shevet Dan in the south, do they know where they're going?
They know.
They're going up north to the Golan Heights, correct?
Yeah.
At least in the general area. Vayavo Har Ephraim ad Beit Micha vayalinu shan. They come to Har Ephraim, to the house of Micha. What's the oddity of these two migration patterns, if you will. The Levi from Beit Lechem Yehuda to Har Ephraim, to House of Micha. And Tzor'ah Neshta'ol Shevet Dan through Har Ephraim to Beit Micha. The oddity is...
not exactly the most direct way.
Well, no, it is the most direct way.
But they're close to Shiloh.
Right. The oddity is that they have to travel almost right through Shiloh to get where they're going. If you look at the map, here is, let's say, Beit Lechem Yehuda. Here is Har Ephraim, area of Shechem. Shiloh is the southern tip. Shiloh is almost is in the area of Har Ephraim, but the southern half of Har Ephraim, just north of Binyamin. Binyamin is the northern border of Binyamin is Beit El. Shiloh is up here in the middle of Har Ephraim, which goes all the way up to just below Shechem. I think Shechem is already in Shevet Menashe, if I'm not mistaken. So they have to come all the way into the heart of Har Ephraim in order to get to Beit Micha. Now the irony is we don't necessarily know where Beit Micha is. But we do know the general area. The general area is in this mountain range called Har Ephraim. If you take the map that I gave you this morning and you turn it over, you have a kind of zeroed in close-up map of this area from Yehuda in the south, Yerushalayim in the center, Binyamin just north of Yerushalayim, Shiloh north of Binyamin. The area of Har Ephraim is marked on the map, up to Shechem. Somewhere between Shiloh and Shechem is the area of Beit Micha. We don't know for sure where, but somewhere between Shiloh and Shechem. So, think about it for a moment from the perspective of, let's say, the Levi. Shevet Dan may be less dramatic, but to think about it from the perspective of this Levi. You have this Levi who we don't yet know in the text his true identity. He's headed north in order to find somewhere to live, somewhere to work, somewhere to operate, somewhere to be a Levi. And you pass right by Shiloh and you go to Beit Micha. Assuming that we're talking about a period of time that is contemporary to Shiloh, and no matter how you slice or dice the time frame, the Mishkan in Shiloh is standing there. It's operating. Whether it's an early story, in which case it's a generation after Shiloh was set up, or it's a late story, in which case it's a generation before Eli, and the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. However you slice and dice it, Shiloh is operating. Functioning as the Mishkan of Hashem.
Maybe he went there and got rejected.
Maybe he went and got rejected, it's unclear, but the Shevet Dan, there's no indication that he even get there. The whole notion that this operation of Micha's temple is in Har Ephraim, which is so central to the story, the constant references to Har Ephraim and to this house of Micha and Shevet Dan and the 600 soldiers from Shevet Dan, they get to Har Ephraim to sojourn, to dwell, to spend the night, and they end up in house in Beit Micha. All of this happening, Kol Yemei Hayot Beit Elokim B'Shiloh, as the text ends, right? Contemporary to the Mishkan in Shiloh, really begs the question of the role of Shiloh and the role of the Mishkan in Shiloh through this entire time
period.
It's
very strange, because the excuse you would make not to go to Shiloh for Karbonot is that it's too far. But if you're already on Har Ephraim,
if you are correct,
it seems ridiculous.
Correct. And if you add to it the role that the Mishkan plays in the rest of Tanakh, think about, you've read through or studied in part, some of you have studied Sefer Shmuel. Think about how central the role of the Aron, the Mizbeach, the components of the Mishkan, the Kohen, the Urim V'Tumim, the concepts that make up the Mishkan, and how central a role they played in the story of David HaMelech, in the story of Shaul, in the story of the building, the rest of Tanakh, the Beit HaMikdash, the kings. It's... you couldn't move 2 feet in Tanakh without some reference, or 2 chapters, without some reference to one of the icons or components of the Mishkan itself. Whether it be the Aron or the Mizbeach or the Korban or the Urim V'Tumim or the king's relationship with the Kohen or the Navi's relationship with the Kohen. Tanakh revolves around the theme of the Mikdash.
Who's operating? Which Shevet is operating this Mishkan? Right?
The Mishkan is always operated by the Kohanim. The Mishkan is always operated by the Kohanim and Levi.
But was it central in the time of Shevet?
Was it central in what sense? Was
the way you're, the way you're,
that's my point. That's my point. My whole point is that the absence of the reference to Sefer, to the Mishkan in Shiloh, to the Mishkan in Sefer Shoftim, is not only remarkable; it's extraordinary, and it's troublesome. It's very troublesome, because the Torah sets out the Mishkan / Mikdash as the central motif of Jewish life. All of Sefer VeYikra, half of Sefer Dvarim, it's all about what this Mishkan / Mikdash means to the Jewish people in terms of the central authority of religious life, the central vehicle for expression of religious life, the central unifying factor in the spiritual identity of Israel. All of these things are built around the Mishkan / Mikdash. And in this entire time frame of Sefer Shoftim, we have not yet encountered the Mishkan once. Now, we will encounter it several times in the next story, Pelegesh Begiva. And we've encountered it now as a kind of backdrop to the story in Pesel Micha. So I have two stories of the postscript to Sefer Shoftim that are really, because the Tanakh leaves out their time frame, they are anachronistic, if you will, meaning they are without time. Not just out of time, but they're without time. They could be understood in any time frame of the book. They are paradigms of this period of history. And the absence of a reference to the book, to the Mishkan, in the rest of the story is so striking that it begs the question, what is the relationship between the people and the Mishkan in this entire 350-year period?
Could it have been in the background?
It's possible. Obviously it's gone in. It's clearly not as central as it was intended to be, or as it will become. The question is really why. That's really not a question of what, because the what I think is indisputable. The question is really what. The question is really why. But I'll show you another example. Take a look a couple of chapters later in Perek Chav Aleph.
Have anything to do with the population? How many people were living there?
I doubt it, because I don't think one area is any more or less populated than any other. And Yeshua put the Mishkan in Shiloh specifically because it was so central. Because it was so central. It was literally smack center in the of the country. And the most populated regions of the country were always the hills, always the mountains, between Yudah and the Sharon, what we call the Sharon today, or what was known in at that period of time known as Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim in the period of Sefer Shoftim is essentially what we call the area of the Sharon today, because it becomes known as the Sharon in later period of Tanakh, the Book of Kings. But take a look in Shmuel, in Shoftim Perachav Aleph, which is almost the end of the Book of Shoftim, Pasuk Yud Tet. This is a verse unrelated to our story at all. It has to do with the conclusion of the story of Pelegesh Begiva. Do you want to move up? You might be able to see. I don't know. You see? I know. Come over. It's nothing to do with height. It's just back of the room on the other side. I sort of can't see people, but all right. If you want to move up, you can. Build up a chair right here with this. Pasuk Yutet. Vayomru. Hine Chag Hashem Bishilo. The pasuk talks about some kind of annual celebration that took place in Shiloh. Miyamim Yamima, every year. So they're describing this, it's the source of the story of Tu B'Av, where there were girls would go out and dance in the streets and create shiduchim. Not our issue for now, but look at this pasuk. Vayomru Hine Chag Hashem Bishilo Miyamim Yamima. No, there was a celebration in Shiloh every year. Asher mitzafon lebet el, which was north of Beit El, mizracha hashemesh, eastward, lemisila ha'olam mibeit el shchema, just east of the road that went from Beit El to Shchem, Umenegev Lelevona, south of the city of Levona. What are we describing?
The exact location of
the location of Shiloh. Think about it in these terms. Describing an event that takes place in Yerushalayim in modern times and identifying Yerushalayim as that city that sits in the hills just east of, just north of, just west of. You know where Yerushalayim is?
You need a GPS to find
it. GPS. It's remarkable. I mean, you can walk out of your house in any place in Yerushalayim and walk to the old city without having to ask directions once, almost. Well, who doesn't know where Yerushalayim is? Who doesn't know where the old city is? Granted, in the old city itself, maybe you might get a little lost. But here's a pasuk in the middle of Sefer Shoftim, at the end of Sefer Shoftim, describing Shiloh. Oh, Shiloh. You know where Shiloh is? It's between Beit El and Shechem. Yerushalayim is between Yericho and Tel Aviv. It's about the same cross-reference. Between Beit El and Shechem, it was all of Har Ephraim. It's like saying, okay, so Yerushalayim is somewhere between Tel Aviv and Yaf. Sorry, Dina, what were you...
Doesn't it beg the question that maybe there were people who really didn't know?
That's my point.
That's the whole idea.
That's my point. Clearly they didn't know. That's exactly my point. Clearly they don't know about Shiloh. They don't know about the Mishkan. But it's remarkable that in this period of time, you could have the Mishkan operating in Shiloh. Nobody knows about it. Nobody even knows where Shiloh is. Well, nobody, but certainly a small number. People traveling through Har Ephraim, and they miss it. It reminds me of the line at the end in Fiddler on the Roof, where they get the eviction notice about Anatevka, and they sing this beautiful song about Anatevka, and it starts with the line, you know, people who've been through Anatevka, people who passed through Anatevka don't even know they've been here. People who passed through Shiloh don't even know they've been there. And they're all getting to Beit Micha. Micha is operating the largest bed and breakfast idolatries telltale in the region.
That's what Shiloh was missing, a bed and breakfast.
You know, part of it may be, though,
it could very well be. You know what? You laugh. Yeah. But in other terminology and in other phrases and in other ways, that's precisely what Chazal tells us.
If you think about the context, except for the pilgrimage, what the Tanakh says, people didn't travel distances. So, I mean, in the United States, 50 years ago, most people didn't go, 100 miles from their house. So,
yes and no. First of all, there's a mitzvah in the Torah to go to the Mishkan three times a year. And second of all, they are traveling. Clearly they're traveling. Tanakh is filled with stories of... And the Levi, and is traveling through. And the next story is the Levi, and Pilegish Begiva, this Levi is traveling just on a journey. The story of Shaul, and he's traveling to, and he gets to Shmuel. There's lots of migration patterns taking place. This is a small country. It's a small country. The application of that, of modern mentality of not traveling back into the world of Tanakh, I don't think fits. I think people did travel. I think they traveled a lot. They don't go on Tiulim like we do. But they did travel. They did move. They did journey. They did go. And the notion of not knowing what Mishkan is, it's really, truly remarkable. And, Janet, I'll come back to what you said before about the bed and breakfast. That was a very, it was a very tongue-in-cheek comment. But it's so interesting because it's precisely what Chazal picked up on. It's precisely what the Medrash identified as one of the core issues in the story of Pesach Mishkan. It's a remarkable Medrash. I think you have it on your source page that I gave you from a couple of weeks ago. This one. The same one that...
Do you have any extras?
Probably.
We always give it back.
Not the problem. I've got extras.
It's always here. I wasn't here, so.
I've got extras. So there are your extras. Not to worry. I think actually I have the original here. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin comes at this question from a different angle, but essentially comes to the same question. And asks the following. Mipnei ma lo manu et micha. Why didn't they count Micha? What were they counting? There's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that lists all of the individuals who, because of their idolatry, and because they were known as idolatrous, lost their share in the world to come. It's a list of biblical personalities who are considered as en lechelok le'olam haba. So Gemara asks the question, ma mipnei ma lo manu et Micha? Why wasn't Micha included in the list of idolatrous people mentioned in Tanakh who don't have a share in the world to come? Says the Gemara, mipnei shepito mitzuya le'ovrei dvachim. Because his bread was available to those who passed by. What? Pat is bread. Pat is the Aramaic word for bread.
Pat lechem, right? Mm-hmm.
Pat lech. Pitom mitzuya le'ovrei dvachim. Why was Micha not counted as one who lost? Remember, Micha is the source of this whole idolatry. He's built this whole bed and breakfast house of idolatry with his own coin and his own. I mean, you can't get more of a zara than a pesel, a trafim, and then a kohen gadol, and the whole nine yards. And he's not excluded. He's not included in the list of those who have lost their share in the world to come. Why? Because he's running a bed and breakfast. Because pitom mitzuyalo v'edvachim. Because he's hospitable to those who travel through. Because he's nice to strangers. Because he's kind to the wayfarer traveler.
But they're getting a little more than a bed and breakfast.
Exactly.
That's remarkable, right? Even for a reason. But the fact remains that those traveling through are being offered hospitality. That's a schus.
So we're assuming that these people could stay there and didn't have to pay? I mean,
even if they had to pay. Let's assume for the moment, even if they had to pay. The reality is, he was offering hospitality.
It's funny that we're studying this now, right after the Parsha, about the 30 visitors.
Right. Now the next line is even more, the next passage is even more remarkable. The Gemara goes on and says, about the same idea, Tanya, Rabbi Natan Omer, Migerev l'shilo shloshan milin. We said before, we're not 100% sure where Micha's place of Avodah Zarah was. Gemara says it was in a place called Gerev, and it was approximately 3 mil. A mil is not quite a mile, it's about half a mile. So let's say it's about a mile and a half from
Shiloh.
So Gemara says that these two places were so close that haya ashan hamaracha v'ashan pesel micha mitarvin ze baze. That the smoke that would go up from the mizbeach in pesel micha and the smoke that would go up from the mizbeach of the mishkan would intermingle. They were so close to each other. In other words, this temple of Avodah Zarah wasn't 100 miles away, and you had to kind of take your choice at the fork. It's 100 yards to Mishkan this way, and 100 yards to Pesel Micha this way. Not quite 100 yards, a couple of miles, but nonetheless, if you're traveling through, what's a couple of miles between friends? So at some point or another, you get to a road. At some point or another, you get to a road, and you have to choose. The sign, one sign says Mishkan Shiloh in this direction, and the other sign says Pesel Micha in this direction. And at some point or another, you have to make a choice. They're that close.
So they had to know about it. It's not, I mean.
Well, one second. Whether they know about it or not, I don't know. The issue isn't that they knew about it. The issue is that over the course of time, it gets. The reality of. If I want to take a snapshot of what's going on in the world at the time, they knew about it or not, knew about it. It's not the issue. The issue is what's the phenomenon? Where are people going? Where are people voting with their feet? Right? And the answer is clear. Ultimately, the question is going to be why, but we're going to come to that in a second. Then the Gemara says, "Bikshu malachei asheret l'dochfo." So the malachim, the angels, came to the Rabbanu Shlomo and said, "You can't let this go on. How do you let Micha's Pesel continue? How do you, God, tolerate this?" Fair question. Amar lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to the angels, says the Gemara, "Hanichulo, leave him alone. Let him be. He's running an idolatrous house of worship, let him be. Why? Shepitom mitzuyal ovrei drachim, because he's running a bed and breakfast, because he's hospitable to those traveling through.
But what was his ulterior motives?
Of course, he had ulterior motives. His ulterior motives was to get people into his temple. And the Gemara says, I don't care what his ulterior motives were. The reality is, he's feeding the travelers.
Right.
Now, by in and of itself, if I took that Gemara and I isolated it and identified it by out of context, it draws us into a somewhat dangerous conclusion. And I'm not sure that that dangerous conclusion is what the Gemara intended. The dangerous conclusion that one could understand from this or take away from this Gemara is what?
That it was okay to have this Pesel Micha because he was... Right.
Ben Adam L'Chavero trumps Ben Adam L'Mok. And I don't need to tell you what that conclusion means in today's context. And whole segments of the Jewish world who have adopted that philosophy because of that understanding. Ben Adam L'Chavero, hospitality, trumps everything else, including Ben Adam L'Mok. But I don't think that's what Gemara means. I think the question that the Gemara is addressing isn't necessarily the one of Micha's hospitality drawn in comparison to idolatry. Which of those two values overweighs the other? I think what the Gemara is addressing is a much broader and much more problematic issue, which is, in contrasting Micha's house of idolatry to the Mishkan in Shiloh, if you want to get the full comparison, you have to ask yourself, not in the house of Micha, I have two values operating in contrast to each other, hospitality and idolatry, which trumps the other. You have to ask yourself, compare the idolatry of Micha to the Mishkan in Shiloh, what's the peripheral, what's going on in Micha's house that is drawing the people to Micha that is not taking place in the Mishkan that is driving people away from the Mishkan? That's the question. And clearly people are being driven away from the Mishkan because they're not there. And the Mishkan is abandoned, rejected, neglected in a significant pattern throughout this period of time. That's exactly the issue. Right, so that's exactly the issue, is that the only frame of reference we have to the indication of what's going on in Mishkan Shiloh is the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So essentially, when I talked about the chronology of this period of time, and these stories of Pesel Micha and Legesh B'Kivah, and we identified them as early stories, because the internal dynamic of the story indicates that they are much earlier periods of time, but the fact that they're placed at the end of the story, at the end of the book, is an indication that these are stories that are anachronistic. They are above the time frame. They carry us through and transition us from the Mishkan to, from Shoftim to Shmuel. So it's not unreasonable to read them in sequence and to go from the end of Shoftim directly to the beginning of Shmuel. As if to say, if you want to understand how we reached where we're at, these are the stories that indicate the problems in the Jewish world at that time. And Sefer Shmuel picks up from that very same point of reference. Sefer Shmuel begins where Sefer Shoftim leaves off. If Sefer Shoftim leaves off in the stories of Pesel Micha and Pilagish Begiva, Sefer Shmuel will pick up against the backdrop of those two events, the issues related to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel itself. And in that context, we really need to go, if you want to compare Micha's house of worship and hospitality, then we need to go to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel and take a look at what's going on in the Mishkan. this is already going to segue us a little bit into, for those of you who studied Sefer Shmuel, a little bit of review. These are just copies. You can just pass them down.
These are mine.
Yeah, by only. That's one. Just leave me one. Thank you. Fine, I got it.
So what was the population difference?
Of what?
Only a little population that lived around Shiloh, and everybody else didn't know about it?
No, everybody knew about it. That's my point. They knew eventually. I mean, they're talking about over 350 years. How can you not know about how can you not know about Yerushalayim over 350 years? Unless over 350 years, people stopped going to the Mishkan. People stopped going to the Mishkan. It would have been, or again, we're talking about trends. We're not talking about absolutes. You can't say nobody went there. Of course, people went. But in terms of trends, the Tanakh is trying to point out a very troublesome trend. And the troublesome trend is that people are opting to go to to Pesach Micha and bypass Mishkan Shiloh. We get to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, again, so from a textual point of view, even if it's not chronological, textually, we go from Pesach Micha Pilegash Begiva to opening of Sefer Shmuel. Textually, it's one transition.
But you said as if it shouldn't be. I mean, they're right next to each other.
What's right next to each other?
I mean, yeah.
Because chronologically, these two stories are 300 years earlier.
Well, we think.
We're pretty sure. We're pretty sure. The textual evidence is almost conclusive. Uh-huh. We've talked about several times. It's the suggestion that these are late stories would make Pinchas 300 and something years old. It would make it just. There's so many pieces of the story that don't fit textually, historically, if they are post Shimshon. There are a few opinions that say so, but the vast majority, including all the Midrashei Chazal, put these stories at the earlier time of frame of a generation after Moshe and Yeshua.
So they put there just as a contrast.
They put there as a postscript. And because they are absent the historical context, so our conjecture, our assumption is that they're there to reflect the entire time frame of Sefer Shoftim and therefore to transition us to Sefer Shmuel. But it's a chiddush. The notion that I can go from Pesach Micha Pelegash Begiva to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel is to take the two stories that are 300 years apart, but by virtue of the way that they're written and the way they're put into the Sefer, they transition us because their themes take us from the story of Sefer Shoftim to the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So yeah, I think it is a chiddush. Okay, opening three psukim of Sefer Shmuel. Vahi ish echad min el ha-matayim tzofim mehar Ephraim. Everything seems to revolve around Har Ephraim. Pilegash Begiva, by the way, also takes place in Har Ephraim. Everything here in these three stories is all focused on the region of Har Ephraim, at the center of which stands Shiloh. Shmo Elkanah ben Yonachan ben Elihu ben Tov ben Tzuf ben Ephrati. We will talk about that pasuk another time, but essentially this individual is by the name of Elkanah from Har Ephraim, has two wives, L'shtei Nashim, one's named Chana, the other's named Pnina. Pnina has children, Chana doesn't, not a issue for now. Pasuk Gimel. Ve'alaha ishahu mi'iro mi'amim yamima. This man went from his city every year to sacrifice and to give offerings to God in Shiloh. V'sham shnei b'nei Eli chofni u'finchas kohanim la'Hashem. And there in Shiloh were the two sons of Eli, Chofni and Pinchas, kohanim to Hashem. The rest of the story is Elkanah's trouble, is Chana's issue, lack of children, Elkanah, and the relationship between Chana and Elkanah, and ultimately Chana's prayer for a child. All of that comes next. The introductory phrase that he used to go from every year up to Shiloh to pray raises the question of why. What's the significance of that introductory statement? And Chazal saw in that statement two very important phenomena.
Actually, I mean, you've read this 100 times, but just from and what you said before just changes the whole
correct. Suddenly there's an
attitude that someone is going to Shiloh when no one else is.
Right. That's exactly what Chazal pointed out. That's the Medrash Chazal. Now, And again, it's a beautiful example of the fact that when we read Midrashim, void of context or absent of context, a lot of these Midrashim are obscure. That's part of what we're doing with the Shabbos afternoon methodology on Medrash, and we're going to use a lot of examples of this. If you take these Midrashim out of their context of Tanakh, then they sound very strange. So, for example, look at the Medrash in Kohelet Rabbah. The first part of this Medrash I'll skip for a moment. Second line. Elkanah, Shayam Madrich et Yisrael. Elkanah was a leader of Israel, and he would guide Israel. Uma'ole otam biYerushalayim b'chol shana v'shana b'derech acher. That's actually a textual mistake, meaning in the transmission of these midrashim over the years, sometimes there's a textual issue. This isn't about Yerushalayim, this is about Shiloh. But every year he would bring them to Shiloh along a different route. B'derech acheret. L'chein katuv, akatuv mekalso, that's why the Navi, when it describes Elkanah's pilgrimage to Shiloh, praises him by saying, Allah ha'ishahu me'iro miyamim yamima. He would go from his city every year. Why the emphasis on from his city? Because every year he would take a different road from his city to Shiloh. Why? To bring them along. To try to encourage them to come. That's exactly what the Radak says. V'Allah, ken haya oseh b'chol shana v'shana. Radak's understanding of this pasuk is exactly that. He would go every year. He would go to Shiloh to bring sacrifices. Uma shema me'iro. Why does the Navi have to tell me that he went from his city? Because he was trying to encourage his city to come with him. Ubidrash, the Medrash says that lo b'derech she'yaoleh b'shana zu, yaoleh b'shana acheret, that each year he took a different route. Ela b'kach, ela b'chol shana yaoleh b'derech acheret, b'shvil lehashmiya et Yisrael v'la'alot otan l'shiloh, trying to encourage others, to tell them along the way, hey, why don't you come with me? Where are you going? I'm going to Shiloh. What Shiloh? What Mishkan? Where is Shiloh? Mitzvah? Haliyah l'rego. Imagine we're talking about 350 years after they enter into the land of Israel and put the Mishkan, build their Mishkan in Shiloh. This is the equivalent of their Beit HaMikdash. And Eli lives in Har Ephraim. And he's trying, says the Medrash, to encourage others to come with him to Aliyah l'Regel, to Shiloh. Elkanah, what did I say? Elkanah.
What changed?
Nothing's changed. It's exactly the same time frame. In other words, it's not. We're not talking absolutes. So of course you're going to have an Elkanah who's going to come to the Mishkan. You have an operating Mishkan. But if I look at the snapshot, what's the conclusion here? The conclusion here is not that Elkanah is going to the Mishkan.
Nobody else is.
The conclusion is that he needs to try to encourage others to do so. That's the point. That's exactly the point. And I have a picture of this guy, Elkanah Nebuch, who remains loyal, is like this little tiny minority, remains loyal to the Mishkan, and everybody else around him says, sayonara, enjoy, have fun. I'll meet you there. You're going to the Mishkan. Okay, Nebuch, I'm going to Beit Micha.
No bed and breakfast there.
Right? You go to Mishkan, I'll go to Beit Micha. I'll meet you afterwards for coffee. It's remarkable. Here you have, if I put this is as you said before, if you put this medrash by itself, okay, so it's a textual nuance reference in the pasuk as to how we come to this idea that Elkanah is trying to encourage others to come to Shiloh. But if you look at this pasuk against the backdrop of the end of Sefer Shoftim, and you realize what's going on in Mishkan and the absence of Mishkan in the whole book, and suddenly these two stories which draw our attention not only to the existence of the Mishkan, but to the neglect of the Mishkan through over 350 years of history. You see it now in the story of Elkanah. Elkanah's loyalty to the Mishkan becomes a subject of great distinction because it's against the backdrop of what everybody else who's normal is doing. Right? Normal people don't go to the Mishkan. Normal people go to, if they're going to go anywhere, they'll go to Beit Micha. 300 years apart, but essentially the concept, I think, is the same. Now, the obvious question is why? What's happening in the Mishkan to drive this neglect? And while we don't know what's happening over 300 years and how bad it was at various periods of time. We do have the Gemara about Micha's hospitality, and at the same time, we have the story of Elkanah's experience in the Mishkan at his time. We understand why it's neglected in Elkanah's time. We can extrapolate backwards. And if you take a look at the Malbim, that's precisely what the Malbim suggests. That the end of this pasuk, V'yala isha u'meiro, this text, this book, Sefer Shemeir Azot, or Siper Shemeir, it's telling us that nobody was going to Shiloh except this man, with his household. The end of the pasuk reads, why is it relevant to tell me that there Koanim Hashem, that there was Chofni and Pinchas, says the Malbim, Hu Tam Lama Rak Hu Levato Ala Me'iro Lerega. If you want to understand why only Elkanah was going to the Mishkan, then you just need to understand who Chofni and Pinchas are. Meshiv Ki Ha'am Hayu Nimne'im Az Me'alot Lerega. The people didn't come to Eli, to the Mishkan, and they didn't come for good reason. Because the operation in the Mishkan is being run by Eli's children, Chofni and Pinchas. Shayula Shimtza b'nei Am, who were disgusting in the eyes of the people. They were corrupt in the eyes of the people. And when you have corrupt Kohanim, the result trickles down. How were Chofni and Pinchas corrupt?
Before we get to that, do we understand that that was the reason people didn't come for 300 years?
That's my point. That's exactly my point. Is that, no, Chofni and Pinchas didn't live for 300 years.
Right, well, we know
my
that.
Point is that here are the only indications we have. Here are the stories that the Navi is trying to identify to give us the patterns. So is it as bad as it is in the days of Chofni and Pinchas throughout those 300 years? Who knows? But I do know that Chazal pointed their finger at the story of Pesel Micha, close to the proximity to the story of Pilagash Begiva, to the story of Shiloh, and said Micha's hospitality is drawing them to his temple and away from Shiloh. I can only conclude if I have that at the beginning of the story, and Chofni and Pinchas mistreating and abusing the people at the end of the story, I can only conclude in between, it's a spectrum, but in between, you know what's going on.
But it's also hard because to understand this, because you know what happens with Pilagish Begiva, you know how disgusting the people are. So Chofni and Pinchas are corrupt, but they're pretty bad themselves. So
I'm not necessarily saying that the people aren't.
But it's that they would, to me, like if they were looking for a less corrupt place, and so they were going to Pesel Micha. I mean, it's hard to see that as being less corrupt.
Why? I think that Micha was not corrupt. Micha may have been pagan and idolatrous, but he wasn't corrupt. He was very hospitable. Right? There's nothing corrupt in the story. On the contrary, who's in the story of Pesel Micha, who's the finger pointed to as the ones who were corrupt? Morally? In the story of Pesel Micha, forget the Chofni Pinchas in a second, but in the story of Pesel Micha, where's the moral corruption? Forget the idolatry for a second. Where's the moral corruption? Whose behavior is reprehensible? Shevet Dan. Shevet Dan, first of all, for their attack on the city of Laish, which is an indefensible, innocent group of people. Shevet Dan for their stealing of the Pesel Micha, and for their attack on Micha himself, and for the threatening of Micha. The behavior in that story that's reprehensible belongs to Shevet Dan. Micha's the innocent in all of this. And the Gemara's charge is a remarkable statement. Leave him alone. God says to the angels, to the Malachim, leave him alone. He's operating a bed and breakfast.
He's just right?
He's being right? Correct. And I'm convinced that were the Mishkan operating at the level of hospitality that Micha's operation was operating, then the Rebbeinu Shlomo's response would have been different. Because then I would have dealt with idolatry to idolatry, right? Idolatry to avodah zarah. But when you're dealing with the Mishkan in its corruption against the backdrop of Micha and his hospitality, then it begs the question. So take a look. Let's take a quick glance for the purpose of bringing everybody onto the same page at the story of Chafni and Pinchas. What is the corruption to which all of these sources are driving and pointing their finger? Herek Bet. Herek Bet. Pasuk Bet. 2:12. Herek Bet, Pasuk Bet. Shmuel. Shmuel Aleph. Uvnei Eli. You get a good sense of who Chafni and Pinchas are. Bnei Eli, Bnei Bliya'al. Bnei Eli were described as Bnei Bliya'al. What does Bliya'al mean? Everybody with? Does everybody have it? Shmuel Aleph, Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Bet. Bet Yud Bet. 2:12. Bnei Eli, Bnei Bliya'al, lo yadu at Hashem. We're going to address this much more detail when
Isn't
we study Bliya'al Shmuel.
The name of like Sut?
No. Bliya'al means Bliya'al, without worth.
Worthless.
Worthless. Without worth. Worthless. Right? Worthless. So that's a pretty harsh statement to describe, right? Evil people. Lo yadu at Hashem. Who did not know God.
And meanwhile, they're the Kohanim.
Okay, so again, when we study, when we do this in depth, we'll go through each one of these phrases. Ladat at Hashem is a moral statement, not a religious statement. Okay. It's a phrase in Tanakh that has a very specific meaning. That's a reflection of a moral ben adam l'chavero component is described as ladat at Hashem. It's a very interesting phrase, but that's a concept we'll come back to later. Now, after a statement like this, Chafni and Pinchas are immoral, worthless, wicked, not God-fearing people, as the Kohanim, you need to explain that. So the Navi does. Umishpat haKohanim et ha'am. What is the law of the... What was the practice of the Kohanim? Mishpat here, not in terms of law, but in terms of practice. This was the practice of the Kohanim. Kol ish zaver zevach, if a person brought a sacrifice, say, Yankel down the road comes, brings a sacrifice. Especially considering the fact that how often did they come to the Mishkan? Even those who came, we're talking about the same period as Elkanah, even those few who came, how often did they come?
Three times.
Three times a year, maybe, if they were lucky. Elkanah, who's a righteous person, comes annually. Only so much of Chafni Pinchas you can put up with. Uva na hakohen kivashela basar. So now they're cooking the meat, and this na'ar hakohen doesn't even give him a name, would come over. V'amazleg shalosh hashinayim biyado, with a three-pronged pitchfork in his hand. V'ika bakiyor badud bakalachat o baparur. And he would stab it into the cauldron. Kol asher ya'aleh ha-mazleg yikach ha-kohen. Whatever piece of meat this fork would stab and pull up, that's what the kohen would take. Kacha ya'asu l'cho Yisrael ha-ba'im sham l'shiloh, which is how he would treat every visitor to Shiloh. The generality here is intentional.
It's like the opposite of that.
That's what Chazal were pointing to. When Chazal talk in the Gemara and Sanhedrin about Pitom Mitzyatz al Oved Drachim, even though it's 300 years earlier, the juxtaposition of the two stories, I don't think Chazal were immune to, were ignoring the fact that you're not talking about the bed and breakfast of Chafni Pinchas, of Micha by himself. You're talking about the contrast between what's going on in Micha's hospitality against the backdrop of what's going on in Mishkan Shiloh. And if it's not particularly this story, so it's a smaller version of it in the earlier periods of time. But if you want to understand why the Mishkan has reached a point of neglect that has reached such an extreme, remember we are one generation before the destruction of Shiloh. This story is here to tell us why the Mishkan was destroyed. Now, we're not finished. Gam b'terem yaktirun et achelev. All of this took place before the chelev, which is the required portion of the animal, of the fat of the animal that has to go onto the mizbeach, before the owner of the korban can eat his portion, or the kohanim are allowed to take their portion. In other words, the kohanim were grabbing their portion before God had his, and man and the owner had his.
Before the actual
korban
was done.
Uva na hakohen. They were no more than hungry. Go back to our conversation last week for a minute. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? They were more than hungry. They were?
Gluttons.
Right. They were desirous. They were greedy. They wanted it. And what's the term in the Torah for desire?
Ta'ava.
But ta'ava is the exact opposite of kachim. Ta'ava is chulin. Non-sacrificial meat is called basar ta'ava. To treat kachim in a manner in which is reflected, in the notion of non-sacrificial meat or tava sar tava, was really a corruption on multiple fronts. Now, v'na'ar kohen, before this chelev gets onto the altar, this na'ar kohen would come, and let me give him a name. This na'ar kohen would come, v'amar le'ish ha'zoveach, would tell the person bringing the sacrifice, Tana basal, it's lot lekohen. Give me meat. I want meat. Give me the meat to litzlot, to put on my steak. V'lo yikach mincha basar mevushal. I don't want it cooked. It's going to sit there in the cauldron. It's going to get cooked. I don't want it cooked. I want it roasted. I want it on my barbecue. So I'll pull it out of the cauldron and stick it on my barbecue. Vayomer elav ha'ish. Nebuch, this poor balabait, whoever he is, would say to the Kohen,
wait a minute.
Let me first bring the korban. Let me make this. If you take the meat before I bring the chaylev on the mizbeach, the korban's pasul. What are you doing to me? Let me first bring the chaylev on the mizbeach. And then the kach lecha. Listen to the next phrase, because it's so poignant. The kach lecha kasher ta'ave nafshecha. Take the meat to your heart's desire. It's the exact opposite of everything the Mishkan represented, the Mikdash represented. Kachim is not Basar Tava. Basar Tava is Chulin. Yamalo, said the Kohen. No, ki atatiten. I want it now. V'imlo, lakachti b'chozka. If you don't give it to me, I'll take it by force. Now, that has precedent. I know somebody else who said, I want the food and I want it now. Esau. Right. Imagine the irony of Kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash treating people like Esau and treating the Kachim like Basar Ta'ava. The whole piece of this, the whole corruption of every dimension of the Mikdash, of the Mishkan. The corruption of the concept of Kachim, the corruption of the Kohanim towards the people, the corruption of values and principles of Jewish life, when the Kohanim are behaving like Esav. There's no mystery here anymore. Of course God was angry. Any surprise that within one generation the Mishkan is going to be destroyed? That night the Navi comes to, the Nevuah comes to Shmuel to tell him, to tell Eli, Mishkan, the days of this Mishkan are numbered. All of this is the backdrop, or this is essentially where the story of Pesach Micha directs us. Here I have Micha, and here I have the Mishkan. Here I have Pitom Metziyat Zal Avrei Drachim, every traveling person and group through Har Ephraim finds himself in Beit Micha. And here I have the Mishkan. Nobody's going to a Mishkan. Would you go to such a Mishkan? Would you step foot in such a Mishkan more than once?
Surprisingly, Elkanah would go
every year. There are some who remain loyal because their loyalty is bigger than Chofni Pinchas. Their loyalty is bigger than the corruption. And their loyalty is to and the loyalty is to the mitzvah. There are some who are just able to get past the Chafnir Pinchas standing at the door. But if you treat every person coming into that Mishkan as Chafni and Pinchas did, the number of Elkanahs will diminish over the years significantly.
Well, it's amazing and rapidly. That the Mishkan lasted 350 years if that was going
well,
on.
Well, we don't know how long. This is the extreme, right? This is the extreme. But over the course of time, right? This is the extreme. So, but over the course of time, this is where it ended up.
Where did I go wrong?
That's addressed in the text. That's addressed very clearly in the text, but we'll have to wait till we get to
it. Yeah, I thought you were going to bring up me, the problem with me.
I gave up last week.
She tried.
Stay tuned.
So what's the takeaway from all of this? Bayamim Mahem, let's come back to the story of Pesach for a second. Bayamim Mahem, Ein Melech B'Yisrael. And if we understood the phrase Ein Melech B'Yisrael as we understood it last week, Ein Melech B'Yisrael means that there's no central place of avoda. There's no central place of that unites the people together. Ish yeshar b'enav yaaseh in contrast to makom ha'shivchar Hashem. What I'm lacking is a place of worship. I'm lacking a mishkan, a mikdash, an ir mishkan. I'm lacking a city that is identified as the central capital of spiritual life of the people. If we're talking about Ein Melech, we can reframe it as Ein Malchut. There's no central, unifying, spiritual center that would give the people an identity of one nation, one people. Every Shevet Dan can't get there on the south, so they try to go up north. What do they do in the meantime on their way? They pick up a Pesel, and pick up a Kohen, and pick up a Levi. And can you imagine every Shevet that migrates builds their own... It's not a surprise. It doesn't surprise anybody that Shevet Dan builds their own temple. Why? Because that's the Avodah Zarah. That's the time frame. All of Sefer Shoftim is about the Avodah Zarah of the generation. And the Avodah Zarah of the generation means that every Shevet has their own identity and their own leadership and their own Mikdash. So if you've got one Mishkan and Shiloh, you probably have hundreds of Pesel Michas all rampant around the country. It's in that context that the background to Ein Melech B'Yisrael, Ish Yeshar B'Enav Yaaseh, stands in contrast to the existence of Shiloh. Shiloh is there. Shiloh is operating. Shiloh is the Malchut. Shiloh is the place that is the Makom HaShivchar Hashem. But we are in a world that is a virtually ignored Shiloh. For right or wrong, virtually ignored Shiloh for so many years that now Shiloh is this house of corruption and immorality in contrast to the Pesel Micha and the bed and breakfast and the hospitality, pitom etziyatz al oshvei drachim, as the Gemara describes it, that it begs the comparison.
And you also don't have a unifying personality. You've got an anti-personality.
Correct. So we will need to figure out a way to unite the people spiritually, bring back the centrality of the concept of the Mishkan, of the Mikdash, of the city, that represents the unity of Israel, as well as the unity amongst the tribes. We're going to need to reformat. We're going to need to hit reboot. And to do that, what do we need?
Melech
Israel. That's the segue. That's the transition between Shoftim and Shmuel. You can't do it. The primary difference between a Shofet and a Melech, we'll talk about this many times, primary difference between the Shofet and the Melech is that a Shofet is tribal and a Melech is national. And therefore, to bring the people together, not just socially and economically, but to bring them together spiritually, I need a Melech who can bring back one place, Makom Asher Yivchar Hashem. That's the goal. That's the mandate. That is where we are going to have to end up. But before we get there, we have to see how bad it really gets. Which brings us to our next story. which is Pelegesh Begiva, which gets much worse. When we finish Pelegesh Begiva, we are going to be crying for a melech. It's not the same.